Session number 12139, Reel 5.
Read in Reel 5.
Well, as I was saying, it was a difficult position to defend. The Germans, mind you, were in much the same sort of situation, and there were nightly clashes, usually by patrols. Most people know who've studied that campaign, there were really three battles of Cassino over a period of about 3 or 4 months. And in the previous battle, the Americans had got their tanks right up onto the sort of little valley between our side of the hill and the other side of the hills, which dropped straight down onto the plain, the far side, and that plain held the German main supply routes and everything. So the Americans very nearly did it, but not quite. And there were several of their knocked-out tanks sitting on this little valley, in this little valley in front of us, 100 yards or 300 or 400 yards in front. And we and the Germans used to make a race in the early evening to see who could occupy those knocked-out tanks first, and thereby break up any idea of them heaving bombs into our positions later in the night. And we got quite good at this, and several very good young officers and NCOs got decorated for their effort, because it takes a lot of nerve to go on night after night, going out knowing that any moment you could easily get knocked off if you were being ambushed by somebody. And also, funny enough, it was the commanding officers, one of your jobs on a defensive position like this, to watch very carefully the demeanor of your young officers and decide when those ones who were going out and were very good at doing patrolling, when they'd had enough. They would be very good, and then you could normally sense that they were going on doing the thing, but they were getting a bit jittery, and they were beginning to reckon that their time might be running out. And then was the moment that you changed them to some other job, or if they were very obviously in need of a rest and a change, because it was a very wearing business, that you would get them sort of sent for 2 or 3 months to a training job or some job on a staff. The sort of quite often the brigadier would take them on as sort of liaison officers or something like that. But in those defensive things, the big burden very often was on the young officers who carried out the patrols at night, and the NCOs who went with them, who quite often would take over, well, had to take over from the officer if he got killed or wounded in these things. Meanwhile, both sides rained quite a lot of shells on them, and lots of people have talked about the approach to Cassino, that there was a space across a valley, this side of the mountains on which the Cassino Monastery and we were situated, and it was called the Mad Mile, because the Germans knew exactly that was our main supply route at night, and they knew where the crossroads and the places where you couldn't spread out on either side would be. And they had a sort of program every night of shelling. And, in fact, a lot of people who during the month were offered a couple of days break to go back to Naples or somewhere, they said, we'd rather stay here because it's too dangerous crossing the Mad Mile. I, in fact, did go back, partly to some meeting at Division, but also they said, well, you can go and have a day in Naples or something. In a way, it was lucky, because my batman, this splendid chap called Mitchell, number 7011909, Rifleman Mitchell, J, the little sort of sanger that he'd made for himself with the rocks round it, he and I went to Naples together, and when we got back, we found that there'd been a direct hit on the sanger that he would have been occupying. So I suppose that was just the luck of war. Well, towards the end of our time, there is incidentally a marvellous book called Casino, I think, written by Fred Madge Delaney, who was the support company commander of the Lancashire Fusiliers, who were in our division. And that gives, to my mind, the most graphic picture of Casino that anybody has written. It's quite a short book. It's very, very good. And towards the end of the time, that month or so, up on Monte Castellone, from my right-hand company, you could actually look down on the monastery, which, of course, was occupied then by the Germans. And one night, I think it was the people who came with the stores and supplies and letters and all that came round to us. Suddenly there was a sort of gleam of light, and a whisper went round, we're being taken over by the Poles. And sure enough, it was true. And a few days later, we withdrew, and the Poles took over. Very complicated performance, having a takeover from a foreign unit who have few, if any, interpreters. But it gradually seemed to work. The only thing that worried us was that the Poles seemed to be far more willing to sort of risk their skins anywhere around. And when we would explain to them, look, when daylight comes, I shouldn't go and wander around in that space there, because you can be seen by the Germans from so-and-so, and they'll immediately bring down shell fire and everything else, they didn't seem to believe us. And we heard later that the poor chaps had had quite a few casualties through disregarding our warnings. But they were very brave, brave chaps. And, of course, they were so anti-German that you almost wondered whether they ought to be allowed near the Germans for fear of what would happen if they captured one. And then we went back to the Capua region again. And it was quite astonishing. So much damage had been done to not only buildings and things such as there were on that casino landscape, but to the trees. All the trees were cut down by shell fire. And we got so used to this in this month that when we came out, whereas where we'd been, it seemed to be winter, when we got out, it was spring. When we got down to Capua, and there was flowers and blossom on the fruit trees and all sorts of things, it was the most wonderful feeling getting down out of there. And the other thing that impressed us was that when we had been coming up through the lines of communication and up to the occupied this casino place, and before, of course, we got to Mad Mile, All the other units in the division who lived alongside the lines of communication all seemed to turn out and wave and say, good luck, and all this sort of thing. And on our way back, exactly the same thing happened. We were all half asleep in our trucks, but everybody would come up, people from the mobile bath unit and the military police and the gunners and anywhere else would come out and shout and say, how's old Bill? Is he all right? And marvelous feeling of comradeship in this whole division. It had a name for it. We had all been together since the beginning of the North African campaign. That is when the division arrived in North Africa. I didn't join it, of course, until Italy. But there was a tremendous camaraderie, and we had quite a reputation with the Germans too. Anyway, out we came, and we found it was spring. And apart from anything else, I think we, when we got there, we at some stage we celebrated St. Patrick's Day, and that was quite an event. And then we got down to a bit more training, and we linked up in our training with some armored units, and we were linked to the 16th 5th Lancers. And we knew then that we were preparing for the final assault at Cassino. And a week or two later, we gradually got the sort of orders of move forward to such and such a point, and we moved forward to a place in among olive trees, but within, funnily enough, within sight of the monastery, which was about 7 or 8 miles away. You could just see it, and the various orders would arrive, and it looked as if we were going to be moving sometime during the coming night. And I thought to myself, you could see all the soldiers were under the olive trees writing their letters home, because they knew the signs of what was going to happen. And so I got hold of the pipe major. All the three regiments had pipes. And I asked them to choose a little open space in the, amongst the olive trees and give the boys a tune. And gradually, all the soldiers stopped writing their letters and they gathered in a great circle all round the pipers. And the pipers played all the tunes that they knew and went on. And you could see all the soldiers sort of leaning sideways and kind of looking up at the sky. And I think it did them a great deal of good. And then the usual thing happened when we had to go and do something. A motorbike would arrive with a little message. And then we got onto trucks and we went forward. This is during the night. And we finally disembarked about a mile or so short of the River Rapido, which is the one that really separated the two sides at that time. And then the next thing we did was to get across a bridge, which was still standing. You could go across it on foot, but it wasn't fit to go across on a truck, and get into a position inside a bridgehead which had already been formed by I think it was 4th Division, but anyway it was one of the other divisions, and they had done an attack across the Rapido and formed a smallish bridgehead from which we, the Irish Brigade, was to be the leading brigade of 78th Division. And for our sins, the Inniskillings were going to be the leading battalion of that brigade. And the brigadier sort of cheered us up by saying, well, aren't you glad that you've been given the privilege of being the leading battalion? And we all sort of looked at each other and said, well, I suppose you can say that, but it might have been somebody else, why not? But inside themselves, the soldiers were extremely proud that that was happening. And so we got into a position forward in the bridgehead. The fog of war really is a fog of war. It's been described probably by Russian writers sort of better than anybody. We didn't really know where our own troops were, let alone where the enemy was. We gradually found out a certain amount of information, and we found out where such troops as we could find of our own knew that, as far as though they knew, there was nothing beyond a certain point. Now, there was a bridge built across a little brook called, well, it was more than a brook, because it was quite deep, called the Pierpetto. And a Bailey bridge had been built across this very rapidly. It was still being built while we looked at it. And that was the route that we were supposed to be going to take. And we got orders that no advance was to be made till tomorrow morning. Well, by this time, it was quite late in the evening. And so we decided that, right, we'll bed down quickly anywhere we could. And a squadron of the 16th, 5th had arrived, and they got into the same sort of Liga area. And at about midnight or so, we were just settling down to sleep. Now, I think it was at about 1 o'clock, but funnily enough, I've got the original message which was brought, which indicated that things had changed. It was vital that we should capture the objective that we were supposed to be going to capture by dawn and not wait till morning, and suggested that the right way to do it was to have a succession of company patrols, they called it. Well, one of the things one learns at Sandhurst, if not anywhere else as well, is that you should never, never do a night attack unless you've done a thorough daylight reconnaissance. So on those rare occasions when I talk to the staff college, I tell them about this to show that in wartime, quite frequently, you have to do things which are from normal military ideas and guidance you should never, never do. So we started at about 1:30 or 2 o'clock. We pushed one company forward and told it to go approximately 400 or 500 yards, and if it found nothing, to stop, be prepared for an attack anywhere, send back a signal, and we would then move up behind it, and then it could go on again. And in due course, we'd relieve it and put another company through instead. And we did this in the dark. And then the next thing that happened was, just as the tanks were going to gradually move forward and cross the bridge so as to be within reach behind us when daylight came, the bridge, I think it was the first tank that went across, he either steered wrong or went right. Anyway, he broke the bridge and the tank fell into the brook. And that was that for the moment. And then the sappers had to feverishly try and build a new bridge quickly alongside. I never saw that happening, but that is what actually happened finally. Well, we proceeded, and in due course, the leading company came up against the enemy, and a firefight broke out. And our people pushed a little bit further, and by this time, dawn was beginning to break. And there was also really quite a thick mist. And a time came when we could actually hear the enemy tanks ahead of us revving their engines up, but they realized, as well as we did, that it's no good trying to do a tank battle in the middle of a heavy mist, because they reckoned that they'd be dead cold meat for our rocket launchers. And so a bit of a stalemate went on. By that time, we'd gone probably about nearly a mile on from where we'd started. And we knew that our left flank was very much in the air. There were supposed to be British troops somewhere on our right flank, but we didn't know where. And as dawn began to break, I thought to myself, I wonder how long this mist is going to last, because here we are, a gang of infantry, completely isolated from anybody, with no tanks, and we know the enemy have got tanks just in front of us. And so we had some rather anxious moments. However, the mist, it was really a pretty heavy fog, persisted, and eventually I suddenly got news saying, the bridge is now open and the tanks are ready to move. Can you send somebody to guide them up? And so my indefatigable batman with another couple of chaps went back and literally walked in front of the leading tank and guided them up and guided them right through our headquarters to just behind the company, which was in front. And by the mercy of the Almighty, just at that moment, the mist lifted and the tanks were there. And then a nice little tank battle went on over our heads, which luckily our squadron of the 16th Fifth won. And so then the leading company and the tanks moved ahead, with one supporting the other according to what was firing. If it was an anti-tank gun firing at the tanks, then the infantry moved and mopped up the anti-tank gun. If there didn't seem to be any anti-tank guns around, the infantry supported the tanks going forward. And on we got, until we got to the sort of the last ridge before the objective that we were supposed to get. And the objective was called Grafton. That was a sort of code name for the ridge that we were supposed to capture. And when we got to this, the ridge, this side of the objective, we could see that it was pretty heavily held and a lot of fire coming from it and a lot of shell fire. And so we decided the only thing to do was to rush the objective with two companies and the tanks. And at the same time, I asked, probably slightly remembering my Dunkirk experience, I said, can I have the entire divisional artillery and any corps artillery there are to fire for 3 minutes onto this ridge in front? And, well, that would have meant probably anything up to 200 guns firing. And from our viewpoint, the entire ridge seemed to sort of erupt in smoke, mud, dust, and everything else. And while we did that, the tanks with the two companies actually running behind them, sort of a platoon or a section or something, running behind each tank as sort of shelter, if anything, from fire. And the rest of us sort of wandered along behind. And it's one of those curious things in battle. There is so much noise going on that you didn't realize that it was quite dangerous. And you saw chaps fall down who had been hit, and you wondered what was happening. Had they tripped or something? And then you suddenly realized that bullets were whistling around. However, we got over the ridge. The enemy really had been very shaken by this artillery performance, and some of them were coming out of their dugouts and things. They had proper dugouts and everything there, really shaking with fear. And I don't blame them much. But anyway, the tanks, unfortunately, went a little bit too far. They got up on top of the ridge, and then, of course, they were seen by enemy half-tracks and mobile guns on the next ridge, and about three of them got knocked out, including the squadron commander's tank, and he was killed. He and I were at Sandhurst together, poor chap. However, the infantry managed to occupy that ridge. We rescued such of those of the chaps from the tanks who were still alive, and we set feverishly about what in army terms is called consolidating the position. We were very worried about our left flank because that was completely open, and so we put a lot of our firepower on that side. And I can only remember the O group, as they called it, which is the orders group, which I gave for the consolidation and told who to go where and which company was responsible for this and that and so forth. And we had this meeting in the open. Meanwhile, everybody was feverishly digging slit trenches in the positions that we were going to occupy. And at that stage, one of these German multi-firing rockets started to shoot. And these things made an awful sort of ghostly whistling noise, and things started erupting around. Well, it was one of those occasions when it was no good scattering, and we would have taken quite a bit of time to gather together again. But these things didn't happen to be coming terribly close. So I thought the best thing was to go on with the orders as quick as I could. And when I came to the thing at the end of orders, where you're always supposed to say, any questions? There wasn't a single question. And when I said, okay, dismiss, off you go, you couldn't have seen people. They disappeared so quickly that they'd gone into a slit trench or back to their companies or whatever it was. But they had done terribly well, and everybody was pretty tired. And we occupied that position until the next battalion, which was the 2nd Battalion of the London Irish Rifles, went through us to take on the next phase in the battle. Our brigade commander had